Well, this is the third Dhamma talk that I've given in this cave. The previous two Dhamma talks, I couldn't bring myself to say anything, so I just sat there and we meditated. So this time I have to try and make myself say something. It is rather a shame, isn't it, that we have to feel this need to talk about Dhamma and verbalize it, capture it with words. Whenever we're on a period of retreat like this and starting to enjoy some solitude and silence, then we start to appreciate the qualities of the Pacheka Buddha, and someone who experiences and realizes the Dhamma within themselves, but maybe doesn't feel the need to speak about it very much. There's a beautiful set of verses found in the Sutta Nipata and called the, usually translated as a rhinoceros horn, Kagavisana Sutta. And same sutta has also been recovered from some of the manuscript fragments from the desert of Central Asia. And it's a very powerful sutta. It's interesting that particular verses of all in the Theravadan tradition have become ascribed to Pacheka Buddhas. Each verse is supposed to have been spoken by one particular Pacheka Buddha in the past. Of course, this is not historical, but it seems to be an attempt by the Theravadan commentaries to explain away the different lifestyle that's been taught in the Kagavisana Sutta as opposed to what was actually being practiced at the time. In Indian Buddhism, as we know from the archaeological record, we have a standard monastery pattern which we can see at Nalanda and so on, where there's like a courtyard in a square, and then around that cells, monastic cells where the monks would live. And this kind of pattern was repeated time and time again right across India for many, many hundreds of years. And there's no doubt that the lifestyle that it talks about in the Kagavisana Sutta is different from that. It has some very nice similes. It gives one simile. If you've ever been to India, and one of the things that you'll always notice in India is that the ladies always like to dress up with lots of jewelry, and even the poorest beggar girls and so on always manage to find one or two bits of jewelry to put on to adorn themselves with. And on their arms they put many, many bangles. They like to put lots of bangles and beads and things like that. And so one of the verses in the Kagavisana Sutta uses that as the simile. And just like if you have many bangles pushed onto the same arm, then they'll clash against each other, ring, and make a noise, a clatter. No doubt the sound is very familiar. So the Buddha said, just like a rhinoceros's horn, one should live alone. Of course, we're used to there is, of course, a scholarly controversy about the rhinoceros and the horn, because most rhinoceroses have two horns. But apparently the Indian one has one horn, I believe, like a unicorn. Another simile is very nice about the deer, like the deer that's the wild deer in the forest. And would go wherever he wishes, seeking for food, for pasture. In just the same way, the monk would be like free and unbound. And it starts out with these very challenging lines, saying that basically that somebody who is practicing this kind of Dhamma doesn't have any concern for companions and friends and so on. They're not worried about their family. They're not worried about what other people think or how they respond to what they're doing. But they're just somebody who's intent on practicing. Eko tere kagavisana kapo. They would wander alone like a rhinoceros's horn. It's not to say that the particular verses are against good companionship. Quite the opposite. Elsewhere they also say that if you find a good companion in the Dhamma, then you should live and practice together with them, supporting each other in your practice. But makes the quite accurate observation that it's difficult to find good friends. Dullabha. It's hard to get good friends these days. Good friends in the Dhamma, people who want to support you in your practice. If we do find those good friends, if we find those companions who we want to share space with, who we're happy to share time for, and who we can give each other our hearts, give each other our belief, our trust, abhibhuya sabbani parisayani, then overcoming all obstacles, one would practice or live together with that person. So that's this very beautiful attitude which the Kagavisana Sutta is trying to impress on us. It's like the friendship and companionship is not something we should be seeking for its own sake. We don't just make friends so we can distract ourselves and then feel good about ourselves, but so that we can have that support in our practice. And if we can't get that, then there's no point in whinging about it. There's no point in whining and complaining about everybody else. Then just leave them behind. If we're living here in this monastery, you don't have to take each other back to your kutis. In fact, you can't. You're not allowed. Leave them. Leave everybody else at the house. When you go back to your kuti or your cave or wherever you're dwelling, you go there alone. You stay there alone. So for myself, this is one of the things I cherish the most about staying in a monastery, forest monastery. When I go back to my kuti, I know that I'm alone. And really, I don't want anybody to come and disturb me. So please remember this in the future. You can come and disturb me if somebody has a Sangha Disesa offense, they can come. If they get jhanas or enlightenment, then you're most welcome at any time of the day or night. That's about it. Or if someone gets murdered, which happened a couple of years ago, and Danny came to my cave, I thought, what is he coming? It better be something really important. And a girl had been murdered off the monastery property. I thought, oh, okay, that's important enough. So, because we treasure that, why we go to such lengths to make a monastery like this. Of course, it's much easier to do a dorm monastery like they often had in the ancient Indian times. I presume that they also had forest monasteries and so on in ancient India, but they, of course, haven't survived because they were built of wood and some bamboo and things like that. The ones that have survived were the very big, well-supported, expensive monasteries, and they're tend to be where the monks live in all in together. When the Muslims came, they thought they were fortresses. They saw the monasteries, they thought they were fortresses. So there's something unique and something quite irreplaceable about that sense of solitude and that sense of being with yourself, not having any agendas, not having to be anybody, not having to prove anything, just to be perfectly content and still. And see if we can make that time we spend at our kutis into something that's very special. We try to practice a very close and careful sense of mindfulness as soon as we arrive back at our kutis, and try to notice all of those things. We feel, when we're opening the kuti door, we feel the cold of the door handle. In stepping inside, maybe taking the broom, sweeping it out, doing what we have to do to make it neat and clean, taking a little bit of extra care and attention to look after it. Remember that all of these dwellings that we stay in, none of us own any of these. We don't own this cave. We don't own the dwellings. We don't own the kutis or caves we're staying in. We only just use them temporarily. Since I've been here for, 3.5 years, I've stayed in just about every kuti, except for some of the new ones. Almost every kuti and so on I've stayed in. I've never stayed anywhere more than a few months at a time. And so this also is part of the forest tradition, that we don't think of any dwelling as being belonging to us personally. We don't get attached to it, but we move around, stay in different places, be content with whatever place we have. It's good enough. It may not be perfect, but it's good enough. If there was that saying we were talking about the other day, if the overhang is big enough to stop your knees from getting wet when it rains, that's enough for somebody who's intent on striving. So there you go, that's your standard. If it's enough to keep the water off your knees when it's raining. So I think Bhante Bobcat's cave is maybe just big enough for that, not much more. It's quite an extraordinary thing, isn't it, that in this place that, we can have this forest and these tracks that walk around, and in that space, in that area, dotted here and there, are these people, these human beings who are trying to meditate and become enlightened. Isn't that just extraordinary? And all the people here have, we have options, we have choices. It's not like in some cultures where perhaps maybe your parents come and put you in the monastery when you're young and sort of get rid of you and stick you in the monastery and you don't know anything else. But all the people here are quite able, quite capable people. If we wanted to live out there in the world, we could do that. We didn't come here to, you know, escape from, you know, poverty or anything like that. We came here because we're really sincere about our spiritual practice. Even though, in some degree, times changed since the Buddha taught the Kagavisana Sutta. You know, we have our kind of notions of private property these days. If we were to literally just kind of wander around wherever we wanted and just camp in anybody's backyard and say, oh, this is good enough for a monk intent on striving and just sort of sit down in someone's backyard and meditate, might get into a bit of trouble before too long. So, you know, we do need a bit more of an institutional backup to make it happen. But we still try to keep that in mind and try to keep that ideal as like something which is very important for us, not just a dead letter, not something we try to explain away or make apologies for or whatever, but something we really try to live, try to embody. When we're living alone, just staying by ourselves, then we start to have a different perception, a different kind of awareness of ourselves. An awareness which is less fractured, an awareness which is less ambiguous. As we start to integrate our experience, and that the field of our experience is more simple, more clear, so we can make sense of it more. When we're dealing with and interacting with people, where there's always these many agendas going on, many people's desires, many people's attachments, many people's thoughts and ideas. And so we're kind of in that, we're swimming in that and trying to deal with it as best we can. Going into solitude puts that in perspective. We become a person who's not so much identified by our relationships with others, but in ourselves, in our own hearts, we start to find out who we are. This is this inner sense which each of you is aware of right now. In some way we can reflect on ourselves. We reflect on who we are as the subject of knowledge, the subject of awareness, the subject of experience. So one of the things that we want to try to do, practicing here through the retreat, is to bring as much continuity and wholeness to that as we can, so that this aloneness, this oneness, eko chare kagavisana kapo, one would wander alone, wander one, like a rhinoceros's horn. This oneness is not just a meaning separated from, but it means like an integration or a unity. So that word eka in Pali, in a practice context, has both of those meanings. One meaning is like being separate, being secluded, and another meaning is like unification. And so this unification is a sense of continuity and wholeness which we generate through the practice of awareness. So normally, that if we think about it, normally let's say, go back to that just very simple scene that I mentioned a little bit earlier. Let's say what happens when we come back to our kuti or our cave after the meal, and we come back in, and what about that moment? The moment you grab the door handle, you can feel the smooth handle, you can feel the cold of it. There's a certain functionality to it, that there's a purpose. You have to actually do something, you have to turn it and open it. So there's an intention in your mind. There's an experience, a feeling, and then there's an intention of doing something. And at the same time, there's like bodily movement as your body steps through the door. All of those things going on. Now then there's a kind of continuity between that and then what happens next. Maybe you step into your kuti and hang your yam up and hang your robe up on the robe rack. But what normally happens is that because our minds are so scattered, we'll put our hands on the door and maybe register that for a fraction of a second, and then our mind will be off somewhere else on another stream of thought. And so continuity is broken. There's no connection in our experience between that act of opening the door and then stepping inside and hanging up your robes. There's a fracture there. It's as if you're trying to watch a TV program, but there's another TV program. The channel keeps on swapping between one and the other, or that there's static keeps on intruding. Or you're listening to somebody on the telephone and the sound keeps on dropping out. So normally our consciousness is like this. Normally we have these fits and starts. We have these moments of simple just awareness, physical awareness, and then we have these you know, emotional stuff, and then we have these thoughts and intellectual stuff and all of these things going on. And it's all like taking us from one to the other and back to the other and back around again. And so it's just like, it's chopping and changing, it's swirling around. So by practicing this sense of continuity of mindfulness, you're undercutting all of that changingness. You're trying to develop like a simple flow of consciousness from one point to the next. Hand on the handle, turning it, opening it, stepping inside, closing the door behind you, stepping over to putting the robe on the robe rack, and doing it as all as one thing. And so in all of that time, the mind flows. And so even within that, of course, then there's a lot of diversity. There's the experience. Actually, what does it feel like? What does it feel like on your hand to touch the door handle? What does it feel like on your feet? What do you see when you step through the door? All of these things. So there's many different experiences. It's quite complex. And there's also the whole realm of intention. As you choose, what are you choosing to do? The purpose of what you're doing and so on. And then there's like a level of reflection as you are reflectively aware of yourself as doing these things. And then of course there's the emotional tone, the mood in which you're in when you do all those things and so on and so forth. So even within that very simple act, even without making anything of it, there's a tremendous richness and complexity which we're normally only aware of in a very superficial way. So by practicing this continuity of awareness, then you will do two things. One, first thing is you'll stop fragmented consciousness, so that your mind will be less fragmented. By making your mind less fragmented, it makes it more peaceful, it makes it more gentle, it makes your mind more, it gives your mind like a tenderness and a receptiveness. I mean, these are just words I'm using now, but this is something you have to learn to experience. Just a tender, very soft receptiveness. Oh, this is how things are. Oh, that's how that feels like. Oh, this is what this is like. And just knowing that, just being aware of it, not always judging it and trying to manipulate it and so on. Just, oh, okay, that's what that's like. We live our lives just unaware of how much we are ripping our minds up by all the stuff that we put into it. All the talking, the thinking, the ideas, everything back and forth, it rips the mind up. If you keep your thoughts and so on wholesome and good, then okay, it minimizes it. It helps. But still, when you compare that with the mind, which is really peaceful and receptive and gentle, then there's no comparison. It just, you know, sometimes just like this little puppy dog or this little baby kitten. It's so soft and gentle, and we just pick it up and shake it around and throw it across the room. Kick it is how violently we treat our minds. If we really knew how soft and how tender our minds were, there's no way we would treat it like that. Still less would we treat other people's minds like that. If we knew really in our own mind how gentle and sensitive our minds, our cittas are, and that everybody else's mind was just as sensitive, then we would always be so soft and so gentle with everybody else. We'd never use harsh words, we'd never use cruel words. We'd always speak very, very gently and kindly to each other. But it's because we forget. Either we've never known, either we've never seen it, or we forget what this is like. We forget what it's like for that mind to be very soft and receptive and tranquil. So this is the first aspect of this kind of practicing, this kind of mindfulness or clear awareness. And then the second aspect is that it brings understanding. By seeing with a sense of continuity, then you're able to discern the relationships, the interactions between the different parts of your mind and body. And you can see the different kinds of cause and effect, the patterns. How does it feel like when you arrive back at your kuti, as you just come back to your kuti, you put your hand on the door to go in? How do you feel at that time? Do you feel excited? Do you feel joyous to have that chance to practice? Do you feel afraid? Are you thinking, oh my goodness, I have to face the whole afternoon by myself, just me and me, staring at each other? Oh my goodness, I'm not very pretty. It reminds me of one of my favorite old blues songs that went, we wake up in the morning, get out of bed, and go to the bathroom, I look in the mirror, oh man, I'm so ugly. So that's what it's like sometimes. You go and you look in the mirror, oh my goodness, wish I'd stayed in bed this morning. So maybe, you know, maybe you have these kinds of feelings. Maybe sometimes just feeling nothing. Maybe sometimes feeling just bored. Maybe whatever. It could be all different kinds of things. So you just notice this, the flow of emotions. Again, these things always go hand in hand, because when our continuity is broken up, then we can't see the flow of these things. We can't see how where they come from and what they're caused by and how they proceed and so on. But when we can see the continuity, then we can understand them, understand the cause and effect. And if we need to, we can do something about it. We don't need to do anything about it, we don't. And we begin to notice the way that different aspects of our mind and our body relate to each other. And understand like the sense impact, like how much that affects us. Begin to see the relationship of like our feelings and our intentions. You know, you can have the same kind of experience presented to you, but if your intention is different, then that will give very different kinds of emotional response, and so on and so forth. Sometimes you're very scattered. If you come back to your kuti, maybe you've become flustered or something about something that's happened in the morning, and then you come back and then you're quite flustered or upset or whatever, and then you just see the way that you do things. Other times you'll be very calm and mindful and just come in and everything will flow very smoothly. So you notice these differences. So try to keep that awareness throughout all of these things as constantly as you can, whether you're feeling joyous and full of rapture and peace, or whether you're feeling traumatized and neurotic and tense. Just try to keep that continuity of awareness as much as you can. Keep that awareness flowing like a gentle stream, not with any kind of abrupt dams on it, like a stream which is just gently coming down the hillside. And it just kind of meanders on its own way. And so practicing in this way is how we get like a continuity for our meditation. And we should be just checking also our different, you know, you can use like different Dhamma frameworks for checking your own state of mind. For example, you can just reflect on something like, say, the five spiritual faculties, and just reflect on each one of those: faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, wisdom. And just reflect on each one of those within yourself. You know, how's my faith going? Am I feeling inspired? Am I feeling full of doubts about what I'm doing here? About what the path is? Do I feel uplifted if I come in and see a beautiful Buddha shrine and a beautiful place like we have here tonight? Do I feel uplifted and inspired, or do I just feel nothing? Do I just feel flat? How's my energy going? Am I able to meditate? Do I just start to nod and fall asleep as soon as I start to meditate? Am I able to sustain that practice throughout the day? Or is it very patchy? And what about my mindfulness? Am I able to like remember what I'm doing during the day constantly, so that I'm not just drifting off into daydreams and time wasting and so on, but that I keep on like bearing in mind or remembering, bringing my mind back into what I'm doing? What about my samadhi? Is that unity and continuity of awareness? When I sit down to meditate, can I watch my breath for a long period of time? Does my mind become still and clear when I do this? Or is it just a waste of time? And then my wisdom. How is my understanding of all of these things? Am I just getting lost and confused by them? Or do I see, oh, okay, that's how things are. That's why my meditation was no good today, because such and such happened this morning. This is why my faith has been very strong recently, because of X, Y, Z. And you understand these things. And so when we understand them, then we don't get so much caught up in them. We don't get worried when things go badly. We don't get ecstatic when things go well. Because we know, oh, that's just how it is. That's just the Dhamma. When things are like this, then that happens. When things are like that, then the other happens. So this is our wisdom which understands these things. So this also should be part of your daily practice, is to check these things, check your spiritual faculties and all of the other groups you can use as guidelines, like the seven enlightenment factors or the four Edipadas and so on. You can just check these things in yourself and investigate, are these things working, are they active in me? And if not, then you try. Use your effort, use your right effort to try to arouse those good dhammas so you don't let yourself get in a rut. Remember that all of these things are conditioned. No matter what happens to you, it's always conditioned. You know, sometimes we feel that, oh, you know, it's really hopeless. We feel, oh, I've really run out of energy or whatever. But that's just conditioned. It comes with causes and conditions. It goes with causes and conditions. So Ajahn Chah, one of the statements of his that I always remember is, you know, if you feel diligent, then just forget about it. If you feel lazy, then just forget about it. Just go and practice anyway. Don't give any attention to feelings of diligence and laziness. So that's real wisdom, isn't it? Don't give importance to these kinds of things. You know them. Yes, you're aware of it. You realize it. But then you say, okay, that's just how it is. That's just how causes and conditions are going at the moment. Fine. Get on with life. And so as we settle into the retreat, we all need to find our own rhythm. We need to find our own pace. How long do we sit for? How long do we walk for? How much chanting do we do? Are we going to do any reading, or are we going to put aside our books for the rains retreat? Is there anything else we want to do? Do we have a goal? Sometimes it's good to set yourself something and say, okay, I'm going to learn to chant the paritas for this rains retreat, or I'm going to learn the Padimokkha or the three first suttas or something like that. You can set yourself a goal to do nothing. It doesn't have to be anything too dramatic, but just something that's going to give you a bit of something to do each day. And so we have the time and the space and the continuity to be able to do those things. So I very strongly recommend to do something like that, to choose a particular sutta or a group of suttas or something and learn that during the rains retreat. And so we need to keep on reminding ourselves of this practice of mindfulness. It's not something which just, you know, you just do once and then it just sort of goes along of its own volition. I mean, I'm sure it does when the mind is very pure, but for most of us, most of the time, we need to keep on repeating, reminding ourselves again and again and again. And this is, in this way, it's a bit like the function of mindfulness is a bit like the minister who had to stand behind King Pasenadi when King Pasenadi was very fat. And he used to eat far too much at every meal. And then he had the Buddha taught a verse about restraint and contentment and said, okay, I want you to, you have your attendant standing behind you at the mealtime, and whenever you eat too much, then he has to say this verse about being content. And so that's what we have to do. We have to have like this voice in our head which is going to remind us, you know, when we need reminding, encouraging us when we need encouragement. We have to find those resources within ourselves. And always remember that you know, you can't always have somebody who's there going to be a teacher or to encourage you. You can't always have somebody to support you. Only within yourself will you find that support. That's up to each of us to find that. How are you going to do that? How are you going to find that support, that effort, that energy to make that effort and to just keep on making it, to keep on doing it? Where do you find those resources? Not just to come and do a weekend retreat or a week or two or something, but many months on end of retreat and quiet. Where are you going to find the resources and the discipline to be able to do that? So we need to become our own teacher. We need to become our own guide. We need to be able to encourage ourselves when our spirits get down. We need to be able to lift ourselves up when things get bad. It's very useful, it's very important to assist the practice of mindfulness. It's useful to set ourselves very limited and doable goals. And so try to do this, even though it might sound quite artificial. And it is artificial. You can do it for a while. After a while, you don't want to do it all the time. But just as a practice, you know, you can just set yourself a series of goals, very defined goals. So, for example, again, come back to that example I talked about before, when you arrive back at your kuti, okay, you open the door, so you make a determination, I'm going to open the door, step into the kuti and hang my robes up mindfully. That's all. And so you make that very clear determination from that moment that your hand touches the door handle, that very moment of contact. From there until the moment where you let go of the robe, that fraction of a second where you've hung the robe up and then release it with your hand. From between those two moments, those very clearly defined two moments, you're going to have complete continuity of awareness with what you're doing and not think about anything else. So stop, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and then you do it. You notice that exact moment when your hand touches the door handle, the exact moment when it turns, the exact moment when it stops turning, the exact moment when it releases the handle, the exact moment when your foot lifts off the ground to step into the kuti, the exact moment when it hits the ground inside the kuti, the exact moment when you turn around, when you grab the inside handle, when you close the door, the exact moment when the door handle clicks shut, when you step over to the robe rack, when you take your robe, when you arrange it and hang the robe over the pole, and then you're finished. That's it. Okay? That's very good. If you can keep a continuity of mindfulness very clear throughout that period, then you've done very well. So then stop and then say, okay, now the next thing I do, I'm going to also be mindful. So then you say, okay, now I'm going to do whatever it is, sweep out my kuti or whatever. And then also try to do that, okay, just the same way. And the moment when you grab the broom, the handle, you touch that, there's a moment of contact. That's like a defining point. The more you can clarify your awareness like that with these defining beginning and end points, then you get more of a sense of like non-confusion about what you're doing. You know exactly what you're doing when you're doing it. Just the same as when you watch your breath, you note exactly the point when the breath starts and exactly the point when the breath finishes. And so you have that precision about your knowing. So grabbing the broom, sweeping the kuti out, and so on and so forth. So you try to make a practice out of all of these things. Remember, you don't have any time pressures or constraints. You have many hours to spend in your kuti. You're not in a rush. Try to do things as thoroughly and as well as you possibly can. Similarly, when you go out to do walking meditation and standing on the walking path, and very careful, very mindful of each step as you're walking up and down. Don't just stroll around vaguely, stretching your legs, but have a very clear idea of exactly what you're doing when you're doing the walking meditation. Maintain that, come back and sit again. And so you get into this rhythm. And as we settle further into the retreat, hopefully this rhythm will become more and more natural, have much more of a flow to it. And so by building up this kind of continuity and flow in our awareness, this is one of the most powerful tools that we can have for the development of samadhi. So if you want to develop samadhi, put your effort into this kind of continuity and clear awareness. Don't try to skip over that. Put a lot of time and effort and care into it. The more you can do that, then your mind will like drop into samadhi. It will be easy. Okay, so that's all I wanted to talk about for this evening. So I offer that to you for your reflection, and I hope that's been of some benefit for you. If anyone has any comments or questions, you're most welcome. Well, when we talk about, I was talking about cause and effect just now. I was talking about just being able to, I guess being able to see relationships and patterns between things. And one thing which is interesting is that you can't actually see, it's very difficult or perhaps impossible even to actually see like a causal connection between things. All you can do is you can see one thing and you can see another thing. You know, and then you can experience eating too much food, and then you can experience having a painful stomach afterwards. But you can't necessarily see the causality of those two things. You know what I mean? Or similarly, like you can see, you know, somebody putting a seed in the ground and you can see the plant coming up. But you can't actually see the seed causing the plant. You can just see that process. And so that cause is something which we infer from the experience. It's not something which experience presents. Experience doesn't come labeled with causes. Yeah? It's something we have to infer from our own wisdom and experience. So in order to understand it, in order to understand causality, we have to see patterns. And we have to see those patterns over and over and over again. And it's from learning to recognize those patterns that we learn to understand causality. So this is something we can understand would have been one of the first great insights in evolution for humanity. For example, understanding the seasons. You know, you see these patterns again and again and again where the changes in these certain ways, and then you realize that actually you can grow crops in accordance with these seasons. And so you see those patterns and relationships, and that enables you to do something very powerful. So it's the same way in your mind. If you see one thing happening and another thing happening, these are just like random occurrences. You can't necessarily see the connection between them. And of course, that's how most of us go through our lives. We don't reflect on our minds and why we feel like this. Yeah? And we've almost got this like cult in our modern society. We have like a cult of opinions. And so everyone sort of has their opinion and puts forth their opinion. I think this, I think that. And it's like everyone's opinion has equal weight. But we're very bad at actually reflecting, why do we have these opinions? Yeah, actually opinions aren't of equal weight. Some people reflect about their opinions very deeply. Their opinions that have been arrived at through pain in some cases, their own painful experience. And so that kind of opinion doesn't have the same weight as the opinion of someone who doesn't really care about it and has just given it a couple of casual thoughts. And so we have, because we don't reflect on our minds, we don't understand the cause and effect in our minds and emotions and so on. That's of course why we lead ourselves to suffering. We do stuff, causes suffering. Do it again, 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 causes suffering. And on and on and on and on we go. And we never see that unless we're going to reflect on that. And so that's learning how to see those patterns. So that's why I was emphasizing that, their continuity. Because one of the things is that ignorance, okay? Ignorance ignores, yeah? And delusion deludes. And confusion confuses. And so as long as we have those things in our mind, then ignorance will always be pointing our attention away from where it needs to be. Okay? So this is, ignorance always wants us to distract us from what we need to see. And so as soon as the time comes when we're maybe going to uncover ignorance, ignorance will go into working overtime to get us to look the other direction. Yeah? And so the closer we get to it, the further it wants to pull us away. And so again, this is why we have to have that continuity, so that we're not being just, our awareness isn't being driven around by the impulses of ignorance trying to hide itself, but we have that clarity and that continuity of knowing. Does that make sense? Okay, let's finish by paying respects.
Sampai jumpa.